course on information protection and personal computers and local area networks. I'm Fred Cohen. With you today, you have the following stuff.
This is the course note.
On my slides, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a circled number corresponding to the page number in the course notes that corresponds to where we are on the slide. So if you keep your course notes open and follow what's in there, that'll keep everything synchronized. And I don't need that anymore. You also have, each of you should have a copy of this. This is the ASP Integrity Toolkit. This is software that comes with the course. There's a floppy disk in there. And this particular software is made by ASP, which is my company. But the reason that you get this with the course is because many of the things that we discussed today are demonstrated in here. And there are, I was going to make sure to point out, there are lots of products on the market that provide a lot of these different functions. And the only reason you're getting this one is because I happen to make it and because it demonstrates the things we're talking about. So if you're going to look for products, you want to evaluate for a lot of different things. This may not be the best product for you, but you can use it to explore what we talk about today and try it out when you get home and have something to remember. We're not running the virus course in Sydney this year, so if you are interested in learning about computer viruses, they'll be selling copies. This is a short course on computer viruses out of the desk during the breaks. I think it's $35, and you can give them a company card and they'll bill your company or whatever. So if you were interested in the virus course and just couldn't get to Brisbane, this is a meager but reasonable subject. On to the work of the day. To page 3, which I think is the first page after the table of contents. Basic protection concerns, and we'll all be on the same page and off we go. We're going to start by talking about the causes, damage, and protection to mitigate those effects of those causes, insurance, and trade-offs. Generally, there are lots of causes. Some of the most prevalent ones are malicious people, hardware faults, typos, and power failures. So I usually like to spend a little bit of time talking about these things. Another big thing is, I guess, fires and floods, tornadoes, and depending on where you live, there are various weather conditions. Malicious people, we all sort of know what they are. They're human agents, and usually there's a reason that they're malicious, although it may not maybe in their mind, not in yours. For example, there's this guy that had a hostage in Sydney. There were several hostages in Sydney last night because he didn't get a bank loan for something he needed money for. And so he went to another branch of the same bank and held people hostage, which when you think about it, you say, well, look, if he was going to hold somebody hostage, it should have been the manager who denied him the loan. But in his mind, there's no difference. So this malicious people problem can be very, very bizarre. It can show up in all sorts of strange ways. Typically, disgruntled employees or disgruntled ex-employees are a very large portion of those problems. And in many cases, people are not apparently disgruntled. They are maybe actually disgruntled, but you can't tell by looking at them. If you're an expert in this, there are behavioral indications. But also, we have lots of other kinds of people. We have industrial espionage, which although we generally don't even believe it happens, it's actually there fairly substantial volume. You have a lot of pranksters, teenagers, the so-called hackers, which I usually call crackers, because there are another group of people called hackers that call themselves hackers that are not particularly malicious. But certainly there are those people. There are the people that want your job, and then of course you may become malicious when you want somebody else's job. Etc. So there are lots of different kinds of malicious people. And one of the things about malicious people is they have different levels of expertise. I mean, the vast majority of thefts, financial thefts from malicious people seem to come from a person who's a teller at the bank who realizes that if I claim that there was a deposit and there's no actual check matched that deposit, they won't figure that out for some time to come. So I'll just claim there's a deposit. And those people get caught pretty quickly. But then you get people that process returns who realize that if I enter a product return that was damaged goods. The procedure here is that we throw away the damaged goods, money, this person checked for their account. So suppose I say there was damaged goods, but there were no damaged goods. Gee, then they'll disperse a check to somebody's account, and nobody will be the wiser. So there are people, for example, that will then create a fictitious buyer who goes in and buys something in some form, maybe a friend of theirs says, they give you a stereo for half off. They get a stereo, and then they process the return, but there's no actual return, and there's no tracking of that physical box and what happened to it. And then they disperse a check to that person for the full amount of the stereo, and the person who arranged this whole thing takes half the money and gives half the money to their friend. Another good one is in credit card fraud, people who take credit card numbers. I've had this happen in one of my companies. People who take credit card numbers, write down the numbers and the expiration date, and then go in the order thing, mail order, of some distant mail order house. Now, I'm not that familiar with the laws in Australia, but I suspect they're somewhat similar. In the United States, if you order something mail ordered using a credit card, it's a felony, but which is a pretty serious crime, but it's a felony in the state where you made the purchase. So if you buy something in Florida, if you buy something from a company in Florida, but you're in Pennsylvania, then the company in Florida, in order to pursue you, has to come to Pennsylvania. And furthermore, the complaint can't come from the company that you bought the thing from, but it has to come from the cardholder whose credit card you stole from. And this person, if it's a big business, is calling from a different state. So I've had people steal $10,000-$20,000 worth of stuff. That is, take a credit card number, order $10,000 or $20,000 worth of diamonds and jewelry, have them delivered to an address where they live. Go take it, turn it into cash at 50% on the dollar. And you tell the police about it, and the police say, yep, nothing we can do about it. And you call the credit card company, and they say, okay, well, we'll make sure that this credit card isn't used anymore for that, because they could use another credit card. And you call the company that sold the goods, and they say, we don't care, because the credit card company pays us the money anyway. And you call the consumer, and the consumer says, I'm not flying to Pennsylvania to make this complaint. My total liability was $50, and it's not even my fault in this case, so I don't lose anything. So the criminal gets away with it. So these malicious people problems, typically they're not geniuses. They're not doing something brilliant. They're just doing something simple and getting away with it. Another typical cause of problems in PCs and networks is hardware faults. And there are a lot of different kinds of hardware faults, and the ones that are most disturbing are the ones that go undetected. Certainly, there's a seat right at the end, and another one here. So there are lots of different causes of hardware faults. In fact, there's some very good modeling of hardware faults, and what they typically talk about is the bathtub curve. It goes like this. And what it is this is the probability of failure versus time for a component in a computer. So when components are new, they tend to fail a lot. In fact, for the first 6 months, they have high failure rates. And then it drops down to a very low failure rate per unit time until about as of 15 years ago, the life cycle was about 10 years. So somewhere around 10 years, they start to fail again. So if you buy the newest technology, the newest computer that just came out and this kind of thing, you're likely to get more failures than something that's about 6 months old, both hardware and software seems to work that way. And then there's the burn-in. So when you buy computers, a lot of the companies that manufacture do 30 or 40 hours of burn-in to get rid of those faulty components. So, and disks have failures and they don't bother to tell you about it. The memory failures, if you don't have parity, or with a smaller probability, if you do have parity, memory failures will just set something wrong and things don't work right anymore. And the list goes on and on. A big cause of failures is typos. I don't know if you've ever experienced an extra zero. But that can be very exciting. Sometimes people forget the decimal point and they're entering in a nice $10,000 check becomes $1 million. That sort of thing. So if you don't cover errors and omissions, particular typos are very big, then you're going to run into all sorts of problems. And then power failures are very big. Now, this is very much dependent on where your computer is. For example, where my office is, we get approximately 5 short-term power failures per month. That is 10 seconds or less. Power goes down, comes back up. So if you're running a computer and you don't have an uninterruptible power supply and that happens, your computer is socked in. It's, I don't know if you've ever experienced it. You may lose anywhere from nothing to everything on your computer system, or a network is much, much worse. So you should be looking at covering power failures and these sorts of things. And then there are just a whole slew of these, and a lot of them are environmentally dependent. So these various kinds of causes cause various kinds of damage. And there are four particular areas that tend to be the subject of what's classically called computer security. I call it information protection. And I'll tell you about the distinction if you like. The security historically has meant secrecy. And it's much more than that, because a power failure doesn't go under the term secrecy, but we surely don't want to have power failures just sliding past. And another factor is that when I talk about information protection, I take the viewpoint that information systems are there to help people do what people want done. And so we're not really trying to protect computers. We're trying to protect people. So and there are lots of cases where I wouldn't particularly mind if a computer got blown up. It kept the person from getting blown up. Whereas very often in computer security, we're spending our time trying to protect the computer from getting blown up, and we watch the person get blown up next to it and say, yes, but the computer was safe. So you have to get your priorities straight. This is the black box in airplanes, right? When there's an airplane crash, what do they look for first? They look for survivors? No. Where's the black box? The black box has beepers and has lots of stuff to protect it from being harmed. But they want to know what happened. So there are four general things that people look at. They go into the headings of corruption, leakage, denial, and evasion. And they are opposites of these other terms that we use. For example, corruption is generally considered to be the opposite of integrity. So when we talk about maintaining integrity, we're generally talking about preventing corruption. Not that one word defines it any better than the other. Leakage, we're usually talking about secrecy, or sometimes in the technical literature you'll see the word security associated with secrecy. And the other word for that is privacy. And this is a very strange phenomenon, but if you talk about secrecy, you will find lots of people are radically opposed to it. But if you talk about privacy, you will find that people are very strongly in favor of it. Even though they're the same thing from a technical standpoint, they cause different emotions. So one of the things that you'll find is that just the way you talk about these things makes a big difference in what you deal with. The third vital area is denial, which is in general the opposite of availability. That is, we'd like to assure that the right information is at the right place at the right time. That is, that we don't prevent somebody from doing something they should legitimately do. At the same time, we'd like to assure that nobody is able to do something that they are not supposed to legitimately be able to do. And then evasion, which is sort of the opposite of accountability. And in the broadest sense, this is being able to assess actions as having been performed at the behest of individuals. Okay? And in fact, this is one of the weakest systems that we tend to have in terms of computer security, that is being able to track individuals responsible for actions. And in virtually every modern computer system, it's a fairly trivial thing to forge something and thereby evade accountability. In other words, get somebody else to be thought to be responsible for what you did. And so that's and then there's another really, really important thing to understand that is fundamental and almost always missed, and that is that each defense fails without the others. And I'm going to go into some more detail on these things and hopefully... No. I said that integrity is the opposite of corruption. I don't... These are not mathematically formally defined terms. And in fact, one of the fundamental problems that we face in trying to provide these capabilities in systems is that people don't define these. So in an organization, if you don't define what you mean by integrity, how are we going to implement it technically? And the answer is we can't. So generally what we do is we implement something And then when they ask us about it, you say, yeah, we implemented something, and then they think that that's what they want, but it's not. Because we don't have well-defined policies, and without well-defined policies, you can't model the policy, then you can't implement the model. And so you know. But I don't believe I said what you... We're only just beginning. A long time. In fact, at the rate I'm traveling right now, I'll have to speed up in the second test. There's just some interesting things in integrity. Let's see, in Australia, I believe they're now tracking telephone calls. They'll track every telephone call you make, and your bill will get, every telephone call you ever made will show up on your bill. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but we did a little survey, maybe several thousand people that I've talked to have participated, so I'm going to have you participate. First of all, do you get phone bills with full detail? Who does not? You're the only one here who does not. You should get in touch with you then. Local calls, you pay one time and all the local calls are covered, yeah. But I'm talking about everything that costs you money above the standard rate. Well, do they give you an accounting of the local calls? Well, then maybe you'll be asking for that after you hear about your long-distance calls. Have any of you ever actually tracked all your long-distance calls and compared them to the bill? Has anybody here done that? You ever find any mistakes? One thing, a lot of people don't bother to do that. They just keep a list, and they find out the list isn't accurate. In fact, so out of two people that tracked it, you say you've never found an error, and you say you have. Very good. So that's 50%. Well, let me just tell you what I found. Thousands of people, and I'm very lucky today because the probability of actually getting it is only whatever. But about 50% of tracked telephone bills have more than one error per year. Okay? That is, if you've got 10,000 people who all watch their phone bills over a period of time, say over a one-year period, 50% would report that they found errors. Now, this doesn't maybe seem so significant, but what seems really significant to me is that this is not caused by typos or by human errors and omissions. Your telephone bill is 100% completely automated. That is, the computer is the only thing involved. So this means 50% of those individual computer records are in error, at least. You know, this is 50% of these people detected the error. So you begin to believe that if 50% is the error rate, with no human intervention, there's something wrong with our systems. You know, computer viruses move freely worldwide. I don't know if you've ever encountered any. Let's see, chances are 80% of you in your organization have encountered them. So how many of you have never encountered a computer virus in your organization? 100% have got it. Okay, well, so we'll update our statistics to reflect 15 more people. So these things just move all around the world, and these are a corruption, right? They're an illicit modification of some sort. Land frauds are often simple and untraceable. And the only way I can tell you about land frauds is to tell you about examples that we found. And in fact, but I'll tell you about one that was not found until the person who perpetrated the fraud bothered to tell everybody that he did it. Not in public. He called the accountants for the place and said, look, I did this thing. It was wrong for me to do it, but you should be aware of it. And the accountants, they never found it, and afterwards they didn't find any trace of it. There was nothing they could do about it. But now that they knew, they reported it. The fraud. They called it up and told it. But this person did. This was a system where they disbursed checks. And what they do is you're sitting in a PC somewhere on the land, and you enter in the data about some check that's supposed to be disbursed, and it gets pushed through all the necessary controls. And then once it's approved, the record gets sent down the land. It says, send out a check to this name and address for this much money. And it goes into the second part of the system. The second part of the system records the name and the address and how much money. And that's all just part of the accounting system. Now, when they go to check the accounting records, they check this mechanism that prints out all these checks and make sure all the checks were legitimate. And they check the systems on a statistical basis that do the verification that the check is right and the amounts are wrong. And they check those. But there's no way for them to check the record from every PC on this network that does check disbursement across the global list of all the checks. So what this clever individual did was, he was just finishing high school and wanted to go to college and couldn't afford it, wrote himself a check. What he did was he inserted a packet into the land that said, here's an authorized check, you know, $25,000 or whatever the amount was. I mean, this was in pounds, so it was probably 25,000 pounds or something. So this name and address, and just pushed it down the land, just on the wire. It never went through any of the verification at one side. On the other side, it was a legitimate message. It said, okay. It printed out the check and sent it to him, and he put it in the bank, and he used it to pay for college. And there was nothing in the accounting system that could figure it out. And this is very common. That is, in almost every land-based check disbursement system, based on PCs and file servers, you can do this. And there's no mechanism in place to figure out that you did it. And this is just a simple example. There's probably, I could think of 1,000 of these in a day. Different land frauds like this. The lands are just incredibly weak. In fact, as you were mentioning before, and I was mentioning before, we can't even agree on the definition of integrity. There's been, for the last 15 years, there's been a debate in the computer security community about integrity. And as little as a couple of months ago, there were a couple of relatively famous people presenting papers on integrity. And so there were, you know, in the discussion at a conference, there are three different papers on integrity, and none of them say even close to the same thing. So we can't even tell you what this thing is, but we definitely know that we don't have it and that we need it. So I guess that's marginally helpful. And then, of course, there's the sad fact that BOSS and LANs provide no effective protection. That is, modern LANs, outside of maybe allowing you to check some packets to make sure that the packet itself didn't get corrupted while going down the wire, provide no authenticity of the source of a packet or the destination of a packet or anything else about the packet. And, of course, BOSS, now let's get into another debate here. I'm going to start using DOS as the DOS operating system because an uncle of mine felt very sick when he started using it. But this was DOS. And then when they got Windows, people were whining about it. We called it Windows. So DOS and LANs provide no protection whatsoever. That is, there's nothing that comes with any of these machines that provide anything to prevent arbitrary corruption, modification, you name it, insertion, replay, the list goes on. Privacy, well, let's see, I don't know, again, being from the States, I'm not familiar with the details of your national health system. However, I am familiar with the details of several national health systems, Denmark and Sweden and several other EC countries in the United States, and I'd be willing to bet sight unseen that yours are very similar. There are central agencies that track records of health. Okay, you have a national health care system. So probably everything that ever happens to you in the healthcare system gets reported centrally. It has to do with how they get money for what they did. And so this all gets reported, and it's all in some database somewhere. And who gets access to these records? Well, in the United States, they have a very funny system. Any doctor can call up and get access to your health records. Any hospital, anybody, in fact, anybody in any health services-related industry can call up and get records to everything about your history. Anybody in the insurance business can call up and get full access to any information about anything in your health history. However, you cannot get access to the information on your health history. So if some insurance company does a test and denies you insurance and doesn't want to tell you why, it's tough luck. And you may have AIDS, but they don't tell you, and you can't look it up and find out. All you know is you didn't get insurance. You might get a little bit suspicious. So I think maybe 20% of the U.S. population has access to my health records, but I don't. And I think that's a very bizarre privacy issue. Of course, credit information, my goodness. Anybody, anywhere in the world who gives me a Visa or MasterCard number, I can look up their credit history. That is, I can look up, if I want to, every transaction they have made anywhere in the world with any credit card they have owned, including, among other things, we can probably get their driver's license and all the information about the driving tickets and these sorts of things. We can get access to all the hotels they've been at, everywhere they've eaten, what they ate. In a lot of cases, grocery stores are now tracking what you buy at the grocery store. So I can tell you all about your buying habits. I can tell you what kind of computer you have and just everything. And I'm not somebody special. I'm just some guy off the street who has a, you know, Visa MasterCard thing, and I can do a credit check. So in fact, there was a book, let's see, you're familiar with John Belushi, who American actor who died of a drug overdose. There was a book written about John Belushi's last week or something of life, and it was written by somebody who had never met him and who did not talk to anybody that had seen him in that week, and yet it was about a 200-page book that covered absolutely every step this man made, down to, you know, how many people he had with him at which bar and which drinks each person had. It was all recorded in these credit transactions, and then you know, the transactions at the hotel and all this stuff. It was all on the computers. So this, I don't know what you expect out of privacy, but in the U.S., they have what they call a reasonable expectation of privacy. That is, you can have something private to yourself only if you can reasonably expect that that would be private based on the way the world works today, which means in the United States, you can reasonably expect that if you keep your windows sealed, nobody knows whether you put on your socks or your underwear first, but other than that, you can forget. Everything else goes through all these information systems, and you don't have an expectation of privacy. Now, if you want privacy, if you're launching attack, this is where you can get true privacy. Now, the individual who's going to the store to buy something can't get privacy. But if I want to attack your computer system, I can do it with impunity. That is, I can assure to a very high degree that you'll be unable to figure out that I am the person that's doing this. And part of the reason is that when we send information over international networks, the controls on the information that go over these international networks have to do with individual controls in the individual countries. And by going through the appropriate number of hops along the way, I can completely obfuscate the trail. I will leave no trail that anything less than a collusion of most of the major industrialized nations of the world could ever figure out the source of this problem. I can easily go through the Soviet Union along the way, which is, of course, not one of the industrialized nations of the world, and which is typically not too cooperative about providing that information. I can go through Taiwan, who doesn't even track those sorts of things. I can go through Italy. Wait, if we're doing banking transactions, I can go through Italy, where they don't encrypt any of their banking transactions, and they don't have any authentication, so either no problem at all, and they're in the international network. So it's very easy for an attacker who wants to get into your system to be completely untraced, and so that's the person that can get private. No problem. Of course, typical attacks against the privacy are trivial to launch. If I want to get your information about you, it's a very straightforward matter. I can do it from anywhere in the world to anywhere else in the world, and I can access all this sort of credit information, for example, everywhere you can. Well, you guys, let's see, you check. You probably took a plane if you aren't in the city, or a bus or some other common carrier, so you use the credit card so we can tell what time you got on, what time you got off, and how many pieces of luggage you had, and where you went from there, what cab you took. You can probably find the driver if you want to. Although, typically, the attackers want to do this on an organizational basis, so they'll just get access to next year's strategic plan and use it for whatever purpose. And then, of course, when we get to those and land with the those-based systems on them, there's no privacy protection whatsoever. And in fact, later on, I'll show you if I have it online, which I think I do, a short recording of somebody logging in over a LAN, and I'll go and show you where the password is, and where you're going to go to the path.